Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. The State is appealing the District Court's order granting post-conviction relief following an evidentiary hearing. The question before this Court today is whether the defendant is entitled to be resentenced pursuant to Miller v. Alabama. Before I get into the substance of our argument on appeal, I want to spend a minute on the factual background of this case. The defendant entered the Thiessen home as a foster child when he was 6 or 7 years old and was formally adopted by the family in 1983 when he was 11. Until the age of 12, the defendant exhibited no behavior problems and was, by all observations, a well-adjusted and intelligent child. At age 12, a drastic change in his behavior occurred and he began to have serious behavioral issues. Then on September 17th of 1987, when the defendant was 14 years old, he shot and killed his sister, Sasha, by shooting her 3 times with a .22 caliber pistol, once on the back of her head, once between her eyes, and once in her chest. After killing Sasha, he unbuttoned her shorts, pulled down her underwear, and then fled to Kansas. In December of 1987, the defendant was charged with first-degree murder and use of a firearm to commit a felony. He filed a motion to transfer to juvenile court, which was denied following an extensive evidentiary hearing. Pursuant to a plea agreement, the defendant ultimately pled guilty to an amended charge of second-degree murder and the original charge of use of a firearm. In June of 1988, the district court sentenced the defendant to life in prison for second-degree murder and to a term of 80 to 240 months for the use charge. Those convictions and sentences were affirmed on direct appeal. Then in 1994, the defendant filed a motion for post-conviction relief asking that those convictions be vacated, because the second-degree murder charge to which he pled did not allege the element of malice, which was contrary to a recent decision of this court at that time. Post-conviction relief was granted, and the conviction and sentences were vacated. The county attorney then reinstated the original charges of first-degree murder and use, and in May of 1996, the jury found the defendant guilty as charged, first-degree murder and use. He was then sentenced to life in prison, and the same sentence was used, 80 to 240 months. And those convictions and sentences were once again affirmed on direct appeal. The defendant's sentence of life imprisonment for first-degree murder was then vacated by the district court last year when the court granted post-conviction relief and found that the defendant was entitled to resentencing pursuant to Miller. Regarding the current appeal, the state recognizes that we face an uphill battle given this court's decision in Castaneda. This case, however, presents some unique factual circumstances that make us question whether resentencing is warranted. And I want to focus on 2 reasons why the state believes resentencing may not be appropriate in this case. First, the sentencing scheme that was in effect at the time the offense was committed in this case was not a mandatory sentencing scheme in the state's position. Prior to 1995, sentencing courts had discretion pursuant to Section 29-2204 to sentence any juvenile convicted of first-degree murder to something other than life imprisonment. The fact that the sentencing court had this option necessarily means that that sentences of life imprisonment were not mandatory. Sentencing courts at the time of Thiessen's offense had the ability to consider the mitigating qualities of youth and were not precluded from taking account of the offender's age. Furthermore, in Castaneda, this court rejected the argument that Miller did not apply because parole is possible in Nebraska if the life sentence is commuted to a term of years. The reasoning this court found was based on the finding that the possibility of parole was remote. Unlike Castaneda, however, we actually have evidence presented in the record in this case that commutation was more than a remote possibility.
In Miller, they state that you could have a sentencing scheme of life in prison, but you have to have the possibility of parole. So bottom line is, you're really asking this court to find the possibility of commutation to be the same as the possibility of parole, aren't you? Because you can't jump from life in prison in Nebraska to parole directly, can you?
Yes.
So the in-between step is commutation, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So again, back to my question, you're really asking us to find that the possibility of commutation equates to the possibility of parole and meets the requirement of Miller versus Alabama.
More or less. I mean, like you said, in order to get to parole, you have to get to commutation. And we believe that there was evidence presented in this case, that at the time of the offense, commutation happened with some regularity, and that evidence was not presented in Castaneda.
Well, you're using the term regularity. What's your definition of regularity?
Well, the evidence in this case showed that over, I believe, a 27-year period, 28 prisoners were commuted to a term of years.
But the evidence did not reflect statistically what that would be, whether that's 1% or 99%, does it?
Yes.
So we would have to assume it's regular, correct?
Yes, and I'm not, yes. I would say there's evidence that it happened.
Correct.
So maybe, you know, it wasn't necessarily the norm, and I agree we don't have any statistics to how common it was, but that there is evidence in this case that was not presented in Castaneda.
In Castaneda, didn't we describe commutation as a free gift from the supreme authority,
yes,
bestowed according to the executive's own discretion? How does one rely on that?
I just think it goes back to at the time of this offense, it was different. Commutation happened more often. I know this was similar to the argument we presented before, but we feel that because we have evidence in this case that it actually happened, and in fact, defense counsel at sentencing on first-degree murder talked about him serving 30 years before he was given a chance at parole. So I think at the time it was different, and that the state feels that it should be addressed further by this court.
Counsel, wouldn't it be more appropriate that the legislature, since Miller versus Alabama and our decision, which adopted Miller versus Alabama, has been the law now, and if we all assume the legislature is aware of what the law is, wouldn't it be more of a legislative function to restructure sentencing for juveniles in these type of cases versus us making some judicial determination?
Well, I mean, the legislature has done that for future cases. I still think the question is before this court on whether the sentence that was in a sentencing scheme that was in effect at the time of the offense, or whether that scheme violates Miller, whether it was a mandatory sentencing scheme. So that is what we're asking this court to address today.
As a distinction from Castaneda's commentary?
Yes.
And your evidence with respect to the year of the crime in question, is that in the record? Is there evidence with respect to the year in which the crime was committed? Is there evidence of commutation experiences in the year of the crime?
Not the exact year. It's a range of years. So from, I think, the letter indicates from the late 60s on to something like that. So if we don't have it like that exact year.
If the state were to prevail, what are you trying to accomplish in this particular case?
Well, the state's position is that resentencing.
Because you think he's going to have commutation at some point in time at the discretion of the executive branch?
Well, the state's position is that you look at the sentencing scheme at the time of his offense. And at the time of the offense, we do not believe it was a mandatory sentencing scheme at that time.
If somebody doesn't do something, he's not going to get out of jail, is he? Not going to get out of prison. He'll stay there for the rest of his life.
Right. As I said previously, we recognize that the Castaneda opinion presents a challenge for the state in the appeal.
So do you want to apply this to all subsequent juvenile cases that where he's sentenced to life but has a chance of commutation? That means that's the sentencing scheme at the time does not require a resentencing?
In this case, I think we have to look at a case-by-case basis as the state.
Well, how many cases is this decision going to affect?
That I'm not sure. Our office has been involved in a handful of juvenile resentencing, and this is the only case that we are appealing. Our office simply, we were not comfortable conceding resentencing in this case given the factual differences presented. We believe that we have presented valid arguments in our brief that we would like guidance from this court.
May be a case of last impression. It may be a case of last impression.
Last impression, yes. I don't have anything to add beyond what I have argued already, and I am out of time, so we ask that reverse the judgment of the district court.
A happy coincidence.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pickens, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Jeff Pickens. I represent the appellee, Sidney Thiessen. I guess we all know the law. We know the holding in Miller, and it requires a meaningful opportunity for release upon demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation.
So is the question in front of us, was this or was this not a life sentence?
This was a life sentence, and pursuant to a unanimous decision in Castaneda, it's a life without parole sentence. When Mr. Thiessen was convicted of first-degree murder in, I think it was 1996, he was 24 years old. And that's one reason why the Section 29-2204 argument wouldn't work. But in Miller, the court addressed the commutation argument. It also addressed the transfer to juvenile court argument. And in both instances said that those don't satisfy the Eighth Amendment. I know I have a brief
counsel, what's your response to the state's position that the possibility of commutation equates to the possibility of parole?
Well, Ms. Tangeman's boss is going to be one of the people to make the decision whether Mr. Thiessen gets a commutation. And they're fighting application of Supreme Court, or U.S. Supreme Court and Nebraska Supreme Court law to this case. So the possibility of commutation, I think, is slim, probably non-existent, but it doesn't matter because the U.S. Supreme Court said the possibility of commutation is not enough to satisfy the Eighth Amendment. And this court is bound by what the Supreme Court said in Miller. And you also recognized this issue in Castaneda, in Poindexter versus Houston, most recently in Adams versus State, that one cannot get parole until one commutation. And as Your Honor said, that's a free gift. That's a free gift. There's no right to a commutation. That's simply the possibility of a free gift, and the court said that is so remote and therefore doesn't satisfy the Eighth Amendment. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Do you think that the frequency of which it's granted in the past or the frequency that it might be granted in the future can ever enter into that analysis?
I don't think so. Under Miller, I don't think so. And under Montgomery as well. But there's no evidence about that. There's no evidence concerning commutations except for that one letter indicating that maybe 27 or 28 inmates had received a commutation. It doesn't then say whether those people actually were paroled, whether those inmates were paroled. But that letter goes on to say that there are many inmates who did not obtain a commutation. We don't know that number, in the right case, if you had that information, then I don't know, my answer might be different, but we don't have that information. Justice Wright, I would like to answer your question. And my information comes from Nebraska Supreme Court opinions, from Justice, from the Department of Corrections website. There are 25 Miller cases in Nebraska. Of those 25 cases...
Remaining or total?
Total. Okay. Total. There were also two Graham versus Florida cases, which have been resolved in the district court. One is on appeal to this court, and that's my case. But 25 Miller cases, and out of those 25 cases, This court vacated the life sentences and remanded for resentencing in Castaneda, Ramirez, and Mantich, so in three of the 25. Of the remaining 22 Miller cases, district courts have vacated life sentences in 20 cases. No district court in Nebraska has denied relief in a Miller case. There are still a couple of cases pending, one in Gosper County that's pending an evidentiary hearing, and then one pending in Douglas County where the defendant is at the Regional Center for Restoration of Competency. There have been, of those cases, the 20 cases, or the 22 cases where, well, let me say, in 20 cases, because this court is responsible for three, but in 20 cases where a district court has granted relief, there have been three appeals from that decision. Two were from Sarpy County, and the Sarpy County attorney dismissed the appeals in those cases before her brief was due because Montgomery hadn't been decided yet, and she, in her motion, wrote that she didn't believe that she had a basis to ask for relief, so she dismissed those two cases.
So what's driving this case?
Corey O'Brien is driving the case. This is the only case that's being appealed. And Mr. Thiessen was 14 years old when he killed his sister. The case in Gosper County is also being, the Attorney General is representing the state in that case. And as I said, that case is pending an evidentiary hearing still. They've had an evidentiary hearing on the post-conviction issue. The judge hasn't made a decision yet, even though he has scheduled a mitigation hearing as required by Montgomery and required by Section 28.
Have we ever, in any criminal case, based our decision on the possibility of a future event?
I'm sorry?
Have we ever based any decision in a criminal case upon the possibility of a future event that may or may not occur?
Not that I'm aware of.
This would be the exception.
I think so. And I don't know why this case is the exception. The defendant in the Gosper County case...
And the operative date is the age of the juvenile at the time the crime is committed.
That's right. He has to be under 18 to get relief
it's
under...
not law. When he's sentenced, but it's the date the crime is committed.
Right. I made reference to his age at the time of sentencing because the state is arguing that Section 292204 could have applied to Mr. Thiessen. It couldn't have applied to him because he was 24 years old at that time, and the juvenile court would not be able to have jurisdiction over him because they lose jurisdiction at age 19. So the 29-2204 argument simply fails.
Counsel, was that section repealed before the second trial?
The statute wasn't repealed. The provision that provided imposition under the juvenile code for... cases involving life imprisonment was removed. It was amended to remove that, but that statute still exists.
So if he had been under 18 following the second conviction, could he have been, did he have the possibility of even going there?
That could have been a consideration, but this is just a variation of the argument that the case could have been transferred to juvenile court, which the U.S. Supreme Court rejected. And I would submit that it would be much less likely for a judge to impose sentencing under the juvenile code for a child who is now older than he or she was at the time of the transfer hearing. I've never heard of a case where a judge used that provision and imposed sentencing under the juvenile code. I'm not aware of a judge ever doing that, but I think... To answer your question, I think that was amended, the statute was amended in 95. He was sentenced in 96. But if that argument held any water, then I think application of the Randolph Doctrine would apply, and so that it could apply to him. So I'm willing to make that concession. But again, that argument is just a variation of the transfer argument. And the Supreme Court of Miller talked about difficult choices that judges have at a transfer hearing as a choice of extremes. You either take a teenage killer and have them for a brief period of time in juvenile court, or you take this young person who committed a murder and you put them in prison under the adult system for the rest of their lives. And again, the Supreme Court rejected that argument. The Section 29-2204 argument is the same argument. It just comes up at a different time, at a time when a judge is less likely to use the juvenile court.
The extremes are still possible now. They're just not mandatory.
That's right. That's right. Because we now have a new sentencing range of 40 years to life imprisonment. And while the Supreme Court said life without parole should be uncommon, should be the rare case, it did leave open that possibility. But we do have the issue of judges imposing de facto life sentences, knowing that they can't impose life without parole. They're imposing sentences of 90 to life. And there are state appellate courts throughout the country which have held that sentences like that are de facto life sentences in violation of Miller. And I think I'll be talking with you about that again pretty soon.
I think we've touched on it, but it wasn't necessary to the disposition.
You're talking about Cardillac?
Yeah.
Right.
I believe
Cardillac,
so.
Cardillac wasn't a Miller case because...
That was the end of the analysis.
The district court allowed the hearing that would have been required under Miller and allowed evidence about brain development and those sorts of things. But in the end, Cardillac was sentenced for second-degree murder, and the judge had possibilities of 20 to life. It wasn't mandatory to give life. In this case, in 1996, this judge, Judge Bartu, was required to impose a sentence of life imprisonment on Mr. Thiessen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No.
There is no time for rebuttal. Our next case of the day is Wyndham versus Griffin.